Namaste. Well, we enter this time the 17th chapter in Essays on the Gita. This was published on 15th December 1917 in the Arya. The issue opened with the life divine, the ascent out of the ignorance, then the synthesis of yoga, the higher and the lower knowledge, and then this, the third essay, which was the third essay in a series which Sri Aurobindo had called The Divine Birth and Divine Works. These three chapters were retitled except for this. It dropped the numeral afterwards, but kept its title, The Divine Birth and Divine Works. Sri Aurobindo has been carrying forward the Vedantic summary of existence by saying that this one reality is not a mere existence, but a supreme existent, a person who holds within himself, herself, even itself, a reservoir of sheer being from which all things emerge, an essence of being. And yet, this supreme person can multiply itself and enter into every corner of a manifest universe. It can stand as the universe itself and as every individual inside the universe, all at once, never be confused about its being, and lead all things forward according to their nature to an end which this divine person alone can see, and uses the universe as a stage in which its will is eventually worked out, moving, as we've just heard, from darkness to light, from apparent non-being to the recovery of real being, from apparent death in the universe to a true and abiding life, recovering all that we had at the start, but here manifest in the world. So to recognize that Sri Aurobindo is writing about the Gita, but nevertheless there's a context for his own work is yet another step. I thought I would read to you something that he wrote to his brother, Barinda Kumar Ghosh, in April of 1920. Looks like it was written around the 7th of April, been translated here into English by Nalini Kantagupta. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you. It's quite a few pages long, but it gives you a bit of a context because his brother was considering coming to visit Sri Aurobindo. And again, 7th of April, this is a few weeks before Mira Richard and Paul Richard returned to Sri Aurobindo's side from Japan. And it's at the end of what he would write about Essays on the Gita. He's only got a month or two left in publication. Essays on the Gita would be complete in July. And so not very long to go, just a few months to go when he's writing this letter to his brother. First, about your yoga. You want to give me the charge of your yoga, and I am willing to accept it. But this means giving it to him who openly or secretly is moving me and you by his divine power. And you should know that the inevitable result of this will be that you will have to follow the path of yoga which he has given me, the path I call the integral yoga. This is not exactly what we did in Alipur jail, or what you did during your imprisonment in the Andamans. What I started with, what Lele gave me, what I did in jail, all that was a searching for the path, a circling around, looking here and there, touching, taking up, handling, testing this and that of all the old partial yogas, getting a more or less complete experience of one, and then going off in pursuit of another. Afterwards, when I came to Pondicherry, this unsteady condition ceased. The indwelling guru of the world indicated my path to me completely. Its full theory, the 10 limbs of the body of the yoga. These 10 years he has been making me develop it in experience. It is not yet finished. It may take another 2 years. And as long as it is not finished, I probably will not be able to return to Bengal. Pondicherry is the appointed place for the fulfillment of my yoga, except indeed for one part of it, that is, the work. The center of my work is Bengal, but I hope its circumference will be the whole of India and the whole world. Later, I will write to you what my path of yoga is, or if you come here, I will tell you. In these matters, the spoken word is better than the written. For the present, I can only say that its fundamental principle is to make a synthesis and unity of integral knowledge, integral works, and integral devotion, and raising this above the mental level to the supramental level of the vijnana, to give it a complete perfection. The defect of the old yoga was that knowing the mind and reason and knowing the spirit, it remained satisfied with spiritual experience in the mind. But the mind can grasp only the fragmentary. It cannot completely seize the infinite, the undivided. The mind's way to seize it is through the trance of samadhi, the liberation of moksha, the extinction of nirvana, and so forth. It has no other way. Someone here or there may indeed obtain this featureless liberation, but what is the gain? The spirit, the self, the divine is always there. What the divine wants is for man to embody him here, in the individual and in the collectivity, to realize God in life. The old system of yoga could not synthesize or unify the spirit and life. It dismissed the world as an illusion or a transient play of God. The result has been a diminution of the power of life and the decline of India. The Gita says, Utsiddhayur ime loka nakuryam karma ched aham. These peoples would crumble to pieces if I did not do actions. Verily, these peoples of India have gone down to ruin. What kind of spiritual perfection is it if a few ascetics, renunciates, holy men, and realized beings attain liberation, if a few devotees dance in a frenzy of love, God intoxication and bliss, and an entire race, devoid of life and intelligence, sinks to the depths of darkness and inertia? First, one must have all sorts of partial experience on the mental level, flooding the mind with spiritual delight and illuminating it with spiritual light. Afterwards, one climbs upwards. Unless one makes this upward climb, this climb to the supramental level, it is not possible to know the ultimate secret of world existence, The riddle of the world is not solved. There, the cosmic ignorance which consists of the duality of self and world, spirit and life, is abolished. Then one need no longer look on the world as an illusion. The world is an eternal play of God, the perpetual manifestation of the self. Then is it possible fully to know and realize God? Samagram mam jnatum pravishtum. To know and enter into me completely, as the Gita says. 7.1. The physical body, life, mind, and reason, supermind, and bliss existence. These are the spirit's five levels. The higher we climb, the nearer comes the state of highest perfection of man's spiritual evolution. When we rise to the supermind, it becomes easy to rise to the bliss. The status of indivisible and infinite bliss becomes firmly established, not only in the timeless supreme reality, but in the body, in the world, in life. Integral existence, integral consciousness, integral bliss blossom out and take form in life. This endeavor is the central clue of my yogic path, its fundamental idea. But it is not an easy thing. After 15 years, I am only now rising into the lowest of the three levels of the supermind and trying to drop into it all the lower activities. But when the process is complete, there is not the least doubt that God, through me, will give this supermental perfection to others with less difficulty. Then my real work will begin. I am not impatient for the fulfillment of my work. What is to happen will happen in God's appointed time. I am not disposed to run like a madman and plunge into the field of action on the strength of my little ego. Even if my work were not fulfilled, I would not be disturbed. This work is not mine. It is God's. I listen to no one else's call. When I am moved by God, I will move. Well, the letter goes on for a considerable distance. There's a lot of interesting materials in it. You won't find this easily. This is in Sri Aurobindo Archives and Research, April 1980. I've tried to find it among the letters in the collected works of Sri Aurobindo, and I need your help if you find it. Please point it out to me. I've been unable to locate it. Of course, it's there in the Bengali version, but most of us can't read Bengali and would prefer to read it in English. So if you find it, let me know. By the way, Sri Aurobindo was writing in April of 1920 about the supermind and his accession to that. He would later, in the mid-20s, of course, and certainly by 1926, recognize that the consciousness to which he was gaining access was actually the overmind, and supermind lay still farther beyond. So every step was an elevation gained. It's just that the supramental is not near. It will take a lot of work to get there. To embody it is still a greater labor. Anyway, having shown, I hope, that this connection with the Gita is meaningful, this integration of knowledge, works, and love, to become conscious of this Supreme Person active in us and the world, and to recognize that this Supreme Personality has a native right to manifest itself in the world, and does indeed come from time to time to take up the work directly, especially when great occasions demand its actual personal guidance and presence, is not merely a possibility, but an experiential certainty. We can experience it better than we can explain it, surely. Well, chapter 17, then, the divine birth and divine works. The work for which the avatar descends has, like his birth, a double sense and a double form. It has an outward side of the divine force acting upon the external world in order to maintain there and to reshape the divine law by which the Godward effort of humanity is kept from decisive retrogression and instead decisively carried forward in spite of the rule of action and reaction, the rhythm of advance and relapse by which nature proceeds. That's a hint that you cannot expect to see, to view, to convince your mind that there's progress if you're looking for it to be linear. You have to have a capacious view that can, in a sense, watch the entire universe at one time to see the hand guiding things from behind the scene. It has an inward side of the divine force of the Godward consciousness acting upon the soul of the individual and the soul of the race so that it may receive new forms of revelation of the divine in man and may be sustained, renewed, and enriched in its power of upward self-unfolding. The avatar does not descend merely for a great outward action, as the pragmatic sense in humanity is often tempted to suppose. Action and event have no value in themselves, but only take their value from the force which they represent in the idea which they symbolize and which the force is there to serve. The crisis in which the avatar appears, though apparent to the outward eye only as a crisis of events and great material changes, is always in its source and real meaning a crisis in the consciousness of humanity when it has to undergo some grand modification and effect some new development. And it's, I think, always useful to remember that Sri Aurobindo was a scholar of the highest order, and his use of terms like crisis, coming from the Greek, which he knew very well, krisis, which itself derives from krinein, to decide, renders into English as a decisive moment or turning point. And as we've said before, in medicine, the term crisis often conveys that point at which the patient begins to recover or slides towards death. So a crisis is indeed a very telling occasion. Everything is on the line. For this action of change, a divine force is needed. But the force varies always according to the power of consciousness which it embodies. Hence, the necessity of a divine consciousness manifesting in the mind and soul of humanity, where indeed the change is mainly intellectual and practical. The intervention of the avatar is not needed. There is a great uplifting of consciousness, a great manifestation of power, in which men are, for the time being, exalted above their normal selves, and this surge of consciousness and power finds its wave crests in certain exceptional individuals, vibhutis, whose action, leading the general action, is sufficient for the change intended. The Reformation in Europe and the French Revolution were crises of this character. They were not great spiritual events, but intellectual and practical changes, one in religious, the other in social and political ideas, forms, and motives. And the modification of the general consciousness brought about was a mental and dynamic, but not a spiritual modification. But when the crisis has a spiritual seed or intention, then a complete or a partial manifestation of the God consciousness in a human mind and soul comes as its originator or leader. That is the avatar. So when there is something epochal which must occur, when there is a change of consciousness in the values and thrust upwards of humanity, that requires the presence, the guidance, the hand of the avatar. The outward action of the avatar is described in the Gita as the restoration of the Dharma. When from age to age, yuge yuge, the Dharma fades, languishes, loses force, and its opposite arises, strong and oppressive, then the avatar comes and raises it again to power. And as these things in idea are always represented by things in action and by human beings who obey their impulsion, his mission is, in its most human and outward terms, to relieve the seekers of the Dharma who are oppressed by the reign of the reactionary darkness, and to destroy the wrongdoers who seek to maintain the denial of the Dharma. Now, you'll remember this is in chapter 4, shlokas 7 and 8, where that's described. Again, this is the outer side of the work, to put down the darkness, to defeat the enemies. Light conquers darkness, but never, always, finally conquers darkness, and so there must be a return again and again. But there's something else at work. But the language used can easily be given a poor and insufficient connotation, which would deprive avatarhood of all its spiritual depth of meaning. Dharma is a word which has an ethical and practical, a natural and philosophical, and a religious and spiritual significance, and it may be used in any of these senses exclusive of the others, in a purely ethical, a purely philosophical, or a purely religious sense. Ethically, it means the law of righteousness, the moral rule of conduct, or in a still more outward and practical significance, social and political justice, or even simply the observation of the social law. If used in this sense, we shall have to understand that when unrighteousness, injustice, and oppression prevail, the avatar descends to deliver the good and destroy the wicked, to break down injustice and oppression and restore the ethical balance of mankind. No. Thus, the popular and mythical account of the Krishna avatar is that the unrighteousness of the Kurus, as incarnated in Duryodhana and his brothers, became so great a burden to the earth that she had to call upon God to descend and lighten her load. Accordingly, Vishnu, incarnated as Krishna, delivered the oppressed Pandavas and destroyed the unjust Kauravas. A similar account is given of the descent of the previous Vishnu avatars, of Rama to destroy the unrighteous oppression of Ravana, of Parashurama to destroy the unrighteous license of the military and princely caste, the Kshatriyas, of the dwarf Vamana to destroy the rule of the titan Bali. But obviously, the purely practical, ethical, or social and political mission of the avatar, which is thus thrown into popular and mythical form, does not give a right account of the phenomenon of avatarhood. It does not cover its spiritual sense. And if this outward utility were all, we should have to exclude Buddha and Christ, whose mission was not at all to destroy evildoers and deliver the good, but to bring to all men a new spiritual message and a new law of divine growth and spiritual realization. On the other hand, if we give to the word dharma only its religious sense, in which it means a law of religious and spiritual life, we shall indeed get to the kernel of the matter, but we shall be in danger of excluding a most important part of the work done by the avatar. Always we see in the history of the divine incarnations the double work, and inevitably, because the avatar takes up the workings of God in human life, the way of the divine will and wisdom in the world, and that always fulfills itself externally as well as internally by inner progress in the soul and by an outer change in the life. The avatar may descend as a great spiritual teacher and savior. The Christ, the Buddha, but always his work leads, after he has finished his earthly manifestation, to a profound and powerful change, not only in the ethical, but in the social and outward life and ideals of the race. He may, on the other hand, descend as an incarnation of the divine life, the divine personality and power in its characteristic action, for a mission ostensibly social, ethical, and political, as is represented in the story of Rama or Krishna, but always then this descent becomes in the soul of the race a permanent power for the inner living and the spiritual rebirth. It is indeed curious to note that the permanent, vital, universal effect of Buddhism and Christianity has been the force of their ethical, social, and practical ideals, and their influence even on the men and the ages which have rejected their religious and spiritual beliefs, forms, and disciplines. Later Hinduism, which rejected Buddha, his Sangha, and his Dharma, bears the ineffaceable imprint of the social and ethical influence of Buddhism and its effect on the ideas and the life of the race. While in modern Europe, Christian only in name, humanitarianism is the translation into the ethical and social sphere and the aspiration to liberty, equality, and fraternity, the translation into the social and political sphere of the spiritual truths of Christianity, the latter especially being affected by men who aggressively rejected the Christian religion and spiritual discipline, and by an age which in its intellectual effort of emancipation tried to get rid of Christianity as a creed. French Revolution. I think it becomes evident that to illustrate what he's saying here, we ought to have a look at Sri Aurobindo's letters on avatarhood and a profile, maybe, even if it's only a brief summary, of what the various incarnations are thought to have added to the ascending values of evolving human consciousness. So maybe since this is a rather short chapter, we can touch upon some of that at the end of next week's reading. On the other hand, the life of Rama and Krishna belongs to the prehistoric past, which has come down only in poetry and legend, and may even be regarded as myths. But it is quite immaterial whether we regard them as myths or historical facts, because their permanent truth and value lie in their persistence as a spiritual form, presence, influence in the inner consciousness of the race and the life of the human soul. Remember how Sri Aurobindo began the synthesis of yoga in his discussion of the teacher as saying, instruction, example, and influence. So the instructive example of the incarnations is maintained by the value of their spiritual power, which does not go away. It does not exit the earth atmosphere, but is always accessible and attainable by the rising human spirit. Avatarhood is a fact of divine life and consciousness, which may realize itself in an outward action, but must persist when that action is over and has done its work in a spiritual influence, or may realize itself in a spiritual influence and teaching, but must then have its permanent effect, even when the new religion or discipline is exhausted in the thought, temperament, and outward life of mankind. So I think this is the point where we'll put our markers and finish the chapter next week. What I'll read next is from Savitri in Book 1, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. This begins, I think, on page 47. No, I'm going to begin on page 46. The Earth's uplook to a remote unknown. Why begin there? Why should I not begin at the top where the canto opens? On a height he stood that looked towards greater heights. Our early approaches to the infinite, our sunrise splendors on a marvelous verge, while lingers yet unseen the glorious sun. What now we see is a shadow of what must come. The earth's uplook to a remote unknown is a preface only of the epic climb of human soul from its flat earthly state to the discovery of a greater self and the far gleam of an eternal light. This world is a beginning and a base where life and mind erect their structured dreams. An unborn power must build reality. A death-bound littleness is not all we are. Immortal, our forgotten vastnesses await discovery in our summit selves. Unmeasured breadths and depths of being are ours, akin to the ineffable secrecy, mystic, eternal, and unrealized time. Neighbors of heaven are nature's altitudes. To these high-peaked dominions, sealed to our search, too far from surface nature's postal routes, too lofty for our mortal lives to breathe. Deep in us, a forgotten kinship points, and a faint voice of ecstasy and prayer calls to those lucent, lost immensities. Even when we fail to look into our souls or lie embedded in earthly consciousness, still have we parts that grow towards the light. Yet are there luminous tracts and heavens serene and Eldorados of splendor and ecstasy and temples to the Godhead none can see. A shapeless memory lingers in us still, and sometimes, when our sight is turned within, Earth's ignorant veil is lifted from our eyes. There is a short, miraculous escape. This narrow fringe of clamped experience we leave behind, meted to us as life, our little walks, our insufficient reach. Our souls can visit in great lonely hours still regions of imperishable light, all-seeing eagle peaks of silent power and moon-flame oceans of swift, fathomless bliss and calm immensities of spirit space. In the unfolding process of the self, sometimes the inexpressible mystery elects a human vessel of descent. A breath comes down from a supernal air, a presence is born, a guiding light awakes, a stillness falls upon the instruments, fixed, motionless like a marble monument, stone calm, the body is a pedestal supporting a figure of eternal peace. Or a revealing force sweeps blazing in, out of some vast superior continent, knowledge breaks through, trailing its radiant seas. And nature trembles with the power, the flame. A greater personality sometimes possesses us, which yet we know is ours, or we adore the master of our souls. Then the small bodily ego thins and falls, no more insisting on its separate self, losing the punctilio of its separate birth, it leaves us one with nature and with God. In moments when the inner lamps are lit, and the life's cherished guests are left outside, our spirit sits alone and speaks to its God. A wider consciousness opens then its doors. Invading from spiritual silences, a ray of the timeless glory stoops a while to commune with our seized illumined clay and leaves its huge white stamp upon our lives. Namaste, Jai Ma.